These are technical announcements, so they're allowed. The same announcements I made earlier. There will be an open session, an open forum of the technical committee tonight. I believe it starts at 7:30, but it's on the schedule, in which we will have a discussion based on questions and issues brought up by anybody who wishes to attend. So if there are technical issues, you know, with your work, your workflows, anything that you would like to talk about, it's technical in nature. We'll have the members of the committee that are here will be here, and we can just kind of foster a discussion. So that will take place tonight. And then also there's been one change in terms of technical sessions. Because of a cancellation, there's a new session tomorrow afternoon, Saturday afternoon. Mark Hood, who's with the Sound Directions Project in my own shop at Indiana University, will be talking about our research into reverse playback. And those of you who are interested in that kind of thing can hear him Saturday in the 1:45 session, the Archives and Users session. He'll be the very last thing. There was an hour-long session, the last one there for I can't remember what it's called. There were two people in that session, and one of the persons is canceled, so that last topic has been cut in half. I mean, there's only half of it here. That's right. The third one is going to be half of what it was supposed to be. So, but twice as good. So Mark has agreed to fill in with a little bit of a report on our R&D in that area, okay? I'm not supposed to be up here doing this, but we also... I'm supposed to be in the other room listening to the Irish music session, that's right. Those of you who know me would understand that. But we also had a cancellation, so Chris and I have reorganized the session. And I will go first, giving kind of an introduction to metadata leading into... demonstrating our metadata software for external metadata, because we'll be distinguishing between external metadata and embedded metadata. And that's what the first half of the session will be, and then Chris will take up the second half of the session. I suppose I'm supposed to give introductions. No, all right. Chris says no. Great. Let's not do that. So I'm going to quickly talk about metadata in general and then drill down a little bit to more specifics in terms of metadata for audio preservation, and hopefully a little more specific into what you can do with a software application to help collect some of it in an automated fashion. And some of what I'm going to do here at first is just simply to bring everybody in the room to the same place. Some of it's very basic. We've all seen this before, you know, asking questions that we don't even want to hear the answers to anymore, like this one. Right? You've seen this. This one's a little better. Structured information, I like that idea. I would also say structured information in a specific format in a specific location. And here's one that I rather like, schematized statements about resources, because it is a little less understandable, I guess. it took me a while to figure it out. I had to look up the word schematized. Machine-readable statements, any claim about anything by anybody, I guess. And resources can be anything, so there you go. This field is wide open. But within a preservation system, metadata hopefully fulfills a couple of different functions. It makes the content understandable and manageable. And it instructs end users into how to interpret and to use the data. And these end users are not just people. It also can be software applications that are taking a metadata feed of sorts and then acting upon it. In an automated workflow, you want to have that sort of thing happening. Why is metadata critical to the preservation endeavor? Well, some reasons that I think are probably pretty obvious to this group. And I'll just for fun, I'm going to throw out a few things for you to look at and think about. Take this as an example. It's a very interesting bit of colors and diagram there. Some of you will recognize this as a topographic map of some sort. If I add just the tiniest bit of metadata, you can see that it's my own home state of Indiana, which helps us interpret this resource. Well, even more fun is this idea. I'm going to play some audio. Let's see. What should I do? How shall I do this? I'm actually going to have to go into here, into Wave Lab, and play this nice little piece. And if you didn't peek at the slide that flashed before your eyes there, you'll be saying, what is this? It's a flute solo. Yep. What else can you say about it? Not much. Let's add some metadata. This not only helps us interpret the audio, it makes us feel different about the audio, doesn't it? We react to it differently, and music is about reaction anyhow, and in many ways at a fundamental level. This metadata is essential to understanding what this is. Let's take another example. Let me just sit back here. I didn't quite get time to set this up the way I wanted to. We'll listen to another example, sort of along the same lines. What are we hearing? What's the instrumentation? Most people will say this is voice and drum. Those of you who are audio engineers may be suspicious. Let's add some metadata. Oh, it's only voice. What's going on? Cylinders crack. That's what's making the thumping noise. It's not a drum. And in fact, researchers historically have misinterpreted this kind of thing for many years. So just another demonstration as to why metadata is important. Okay, enough.
What was that?
So I would hazard to say that digitization does not equal access, but then in fact, we need something more than that. The content must be findable, understandable, and utilizable to users. And so if we add metadata to it, then maybe we've equaled access. There's obviously more to that equation than just this. Let's talk about metadata standards, which is what much of the rest of this session will address. Metadata standards define our key terms. They tell us, kind of, quote, the fields of data that we're going to try to record and the rules for structuring data in these fields. Hopefully, they're developed by a community of stakeholders and users who are experts in the field. They help the preservation effort by making our data more predictable. And that helps us, that helps facilitate metadata interchange. And that's sometimes interchange just within our own preservation system, just within one preservation system, when metadata has to go from one place to another. But also, if you take the example of maybe outsourcing things to a vendor and needing to get back metadata from a vendor, interchange is a very important concept within that setting as well. Different types of metadata standards. We have what are called data structure standards. These are the standards that establish these data elements or these fields of data that we're trying to record. Things like Dublin Core and AES-57, which we're going to talk about in just a little bit. We have data communication standards, which here facilitate the interchange of information. Data content standards, which govern format and syntax of the values. Data value standards, these are controlled vocabularies and thesauri. A few words on evaluating metadata standards. Just because you have a standard doesn't mean, A, that it's useful to you, or B, that you know how to use it or how to meet it, which is another issue entirely. But just a few ideas on evaluating metadata standards. Does it fit the material that I have that I'm trying to preserve or give access to? Does it support my access or management or preservation needs? Are there existing tools? Collecting all of your metadata and managing it all by hand is very, very complicated and very difficult and error-prone. So having some tools is pretty essential these days to preservation in the digital domain. Have others used it in similar situations that I can learn from? Who maintains the standard? If a standard is just kind of plopped into the community and then nobody maintains it over time, the standard will become obsolete. So maybe we need to add that to our list of obsolescence risks that we talked about yesterday. And how quickly is the standard changing within the environment in which you're working? In other words, if you have an emerging standard that you're trying to work to, well, that's a moving target, because if it's not public, it's going to change. Anybody had that experience in this room other than myself? A few characteristics of metadata. It's changeable over time as new information becomes available and you have the urge to update your metadata for any given resource, or as the terminology changes. As a simple example, we no longer call lacquer discs, acetate discs. We now call them lacquer discs, which is more properly what they are. So if it's changeable over time, then that leads to some issues, particularly in regards to external versus embedded metadata. So just to be clear about this for those that may not know, embedded metadata is metadata that is embedded in the audio file itself, or video file, I'm mostly talking about audio here, and that goes and is always carried by that audio file. External metadata is typically stored in a database or a spreadsheet, for example. So if you want to embed metadata into a file, can you embed all of the metadata that you want to, or is it too much for the file format to handle? And if you do embed metadata in the file, what becomes the authoritative version of that metadata? Is it what's in the file, or is it what's in the external metadata system? So do you have sync issues between the two? And one of the reasons that's important is that updating files is a difficult thing to do and really doesn't scale for larger collections. So if metadata changes, you've embedded it, it's something that you want to update, and you have 20,000 files that need to be changed, that's a pretty big procedure or more. In a separate, an external metadata system, updating is easier. One of the important parts of embedding metadata, one of the advantages, is that you can identify the file if your link with the external system is lost. Just a few other thoughts on metadata and metadata collection. Some of it is necessarily, this is the man versus machine again that we talked about a little bit earlier today. Some of it has to be collected by human beings. The audio engineer who's doing the transfer work is the only person who knows what is going on with the audio object, and possibly the only person who knows how the studio was set up, what settings were used, and so forth and so on. But machines also can do a great bit of the heavy lifting here as well. And metadata comes from many different places, many different people who play different functions within an audio preservation system in many different parts of the workflow as well. So you can have metadata coming in at different stages from different places. All of it needs to be managed. Basic types of metadata that we're concerned about in audio preservation: descriptive metadata, various categories of administrative, structural, and preservation metadata. And people use different terms for these. These are the terms that I use. There's some overlap here as well. Descriptive metadata is what people have generally thought of as the cataloging information. You know, names of performers, musical genres, and so forth. Technical metadata is the technical attributes of the object. This is typically format or media specific. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about an analog recording or a digital file. They're both audio objects that need technical metadata. Digital provenance, also called processing history, or affectionately referred to as digiprov. Metadata. I think of this as the who, what, when, where, and how of all preservation activity. Who did it? Who did a transfer, for example? Where was it done? When was it done? How was it done? DigiProv metadata is based on events, typically. Event can be preservation transfer, for example, creation of a derivative file, or a cleaning event. An event always has an input. It's whatever audio object you're acting upon. It always has an outcome. It's either successful or unsuccessful, as one example. Sometimes it has an output. In a preservation transfer, the output is typically a digital file that we would usually label a preservation master file. A cleaning event doesn't necessarily have an output, although maybe the disk is cleaner. You could think of that as something different and as an output. So DigiProv is concerned with these kinds of things, including details of the signal chain down to the device level and the settings on each device. I'll say it's all potential metadata to be collected. Whether it's actually collected or not is a question of strategy and resources. Structural metadata ties components of a complex resource together. So an example, that example will be clearer in a minute, so I'll wait to show you something to talk about that. But also the idea that multiple files might be related into a more logical whole. The metadata that ties them together would be an example of structural metadata. Areas of interest in a file where you place markers. Rights metadata, which I'm going to skip over. It's not really the topic of this session. Preservation metadata, I'll just mention briefly. It's a term used mostly by premise, and there is some overlap with technical metadata in the way that we think about it, doing audio preservation, particularly for digital files, and also for digital provenance metadata. So those are the basic categories. We have some standards that are actively being used by the community, including the broadcast wave format, which is now, by all recommendations, the standard file format for audio preservation, a preservation master file. AES-57, this is the number to an upcoming AES standard that's just about to go to public comment, actually very soon. This is a standard, I'll talk more about this in a minute. A parallel standard that's being developed by AES, which is a digital provenance standard, which we call XO98C right now. AES-31-3, this is the beloved or feared ADL format that we're talking about. And METS, which of course is used for wider applications, but finds its usefulness in audio preservation as well. Let's talk about AES-57. This is a technical metadata standard that has been in working group for a number of years, but is about to emerge. It's going to go to a call for public comment, which I think will last for 3 months. Does that sound right, Chris? After which point I think it is ratified as the standard. I think that call is very, very close from what I can tell. It's a vocabulary for describing the technical parts of the audio object. Now, this can be an analog recording. It can be a digital file. Or it can be a physical digital item, like a DAT tape or a mini disc. So it deals with such things as physical properties, like what is the base material of an open reel tape, what are the dimensions of the object, playback speed, and then if it happens to be a digital file, things like sample rate, bit depth. XO98C, which we hope is not far along, not much further from public comment, although it still is in working group. This is our event-driven processing events, which we basically already talked about. Just a word about metadata strategy. Thinking about what you want, what is the purpose of the metadata that you want to collect, what kinds of resources you have available to collect the metadata versus, you know, the cost of getting it and getting it to where you need it. And then some kind of analysis for your needs for preservation and access is an important piece of trying to set up a workflow and trying to engage in audio preservation. Just as an example of two pieces of our strategy at the Archives of Traditional Music, we use a broadcast wave format in which we embed metadata, which is essentially a minimal amount of metadata that we don't expect to change over time, so we don't want to have to update files. Its purpose is to mitigate the risk for us, again, this is just for us, to mitigate the risk of the file becoming separate from the metadata system, So we, for example, embed the file name itself in with the file, so that if the file name is lost, which is a very real possibility, you can recover it by looking at this part in the broadcast wave file. There's another thought there, but I'll get back to it in a minute. We then pair that with collecting a rich set of external metadata using the AES standard, which, of course, again, is not public, but still in working group, and a software application called ATMC, which stands for the Audio Technical Metadata Collector. And here we're trying to collect a full metadata set, which is collected by experts. So audio engineers who are actually working with the materials are plugging into this, as well as project assistant and so forth. Our purpose here is to conform to a standard, in this case the AES standard. And we want to have enough metadata. We're in a position where we're able to collect a rich set of metadata. We want to be able to support many different management and use scenarios over time. So we're just trying to collect everything that we can. The tool that we're using to do this is called ATMC. It's developed under the auspices of the Sound Directions Project at Indiana University, funded by NEH. We plan to release it as open source software. You have to read the fine print, though. ATMC will allow us to enter and edit this technical metadata and structural metadata. It will allow us to collect a full set of digital provenance metadata as well. It will parse files to automatically collect some of this. It will generate an MD5 checksum automatically. It will enable us to look at relationships between objects in a graphic representation. And it will be AES compliant. It's pretty far along the way to being compliant right now, but it's not quite. And I think it might be much more understandable if we actually look at the application, so let's do that. Now, just one disclaimer. ATMC is undergoing a serious development at the moment before we hope to release it by the end of the year. So it will not even look like this by the time it's done. The interface is going to be redesigned. That's the plan. So if you can get beyond the look and understand that the user experience will be a little bit different, to look more at the data that's being collected and some of the functionality, I think that's what's important about this demonstration. So, and the other sort of caveat early on is that this is IU specific at the moment, but the tool is being generalized for use by others outside of IU. So you see things like this IU cat tab right here, which gives some of our information from our OPAC. I mean, that's going to change as we keep working on development. But just to quickly show you what this tool is doing, here's some basic descriptive metadata to help you know that you're in the right place, a title of the collection. Primary identifier is up here. We use a shelf number as a primary identifier. This is an OpenReel tape number 6833. This you can think of as a secondary identifier in AES speak. This is an accession number, which is applied to the entire collection, which in this case, I don't know how many objects are in this collection. There's probably 50, 60, I'm not sure. And collector, David Price. So, basic information. Date of recording. We have two dates, 1967, 1968. The way in which we handle dates has just changed. We're using EDTF, which is being developed by the Library of Congress, although it is also a standard that's not yet a standard. It's a work in progress. There's a use note down here that tells us what those dates apply. Oops, that's not the right place. Tells us what those dates apply to. This is a field recording. It's an original. It could be a copy. It could be a first copy. Its use within the archive. And this is, again, many of these, including this element, are standard AES schema elements. Its use as an original master. It could be other things. And some metadata that is ATM specific, that's not part of the AES standard. The collector's number, the collector numbered this tape, number G. One hopes there's not more than 25 this time. I don't know. Interesting. And the original recording equipment, which we are collecting because we think this is of importance. We actually think that in the future there will be researchers technically savvy who will want this information to help them interpret what they're hearing. And we want to be able to make this available. This is what we know about this collection. The format, this is an open reel tape. It could be something else. It could be any of these, and any of these would give you a different set of fields in which to complete. But for open reel tape, we get these recorded in two directions. Total tape thickness, which is something we always measure now, which we didn't at the time this record was created. Tape base, this is a half mil tape. Magnetic pigment, presence of backcoding, and then dimensions. Many of these are defaults. You know, there's a fair bit of logic within the program to enter certain things. No, total tape thickness. A half mil base tape, that's the thickness of the base. The total tape thickness would be around 1 mil, approximately, 1 to 1.3 mil, something like that for a half mil base tape. So we would take a caliper and measure the tape in mils and enter the data right here. With structure, we get to really something a little more complex and more interesting, and very much this comes from the AES schema. There's a hierarchy in terms of how we represent these audio objects in metadata. The base of the hierarchy is the audio object itself, which for us is this open reel tape number 6833. There are two faces on this tape, and by face I mean a track that is meant to be played in one direction and then flipped and then played in another direction. So face one is the first direction. You can see that its duration is here. And this is calculated automatically by the software from the region durations. And if you then, a region is created based on a basic change in the characteristic of the format. So here you can tell by the way we've named the regions that the playback speed changed from 1.875 VIPS to 3.75 and then changed back again to 1.875. This was a fun one to transfer. Under the region heading, we collect additional metadata related to that region. This is Scotch 144. It's polyester based. It's mono. Track configuration is half-track mono. And at the stream level, you can roughly think of a stream as a channel, at least in our application. This is channel one, and it mapped to the center of the stereo spread, so we would want to hear it in the center if a playback system was reading this. Well, region two was done at 3.75 VIPS, played back there. All of this metadata is inherited automatically, from region one, so you don't have to actually fill that out again. So you get some bang for the buck there in terms of logic. And there's region three. Face two is a different story. There's just one region on the tape, all of it played at the same playback speed. Evaluation. This is not part of the AES standard. This is part of what we want to do at the Archives of Traditional Music. I'll just open this up. This tape was evaluated by this engineer, Monica Tromp, on this date. It was a playback inspection versus a visual inspection. And the engineer was able to rank any existing problems, analog tape problems, on a scale of 1, 0 to 3, with 0 being the absence of a problem and 3 being the most severe case of a problem, and also be able to rank sonic problems as well. And you can see that the engineer chose to call this, in terms of overall sonic quality, again, this is an internal system, as fair with distortion ranked as 1, dropouts ranked as 1, overmodulation ranked as 2. Process history. This is where we get into the DigiProv, digital provenance section here. And we see here 4 process histories. These all relate to 4 digital files that were created, one for each region. So that during the transfer process on face one, we created 3 different preservation master files, 1 for the first region, had to stop, wind back, overlap, play at the new speed, create another digital file, do the same thing again, and then face two was 1 digital file. So that's 4 digital files. And so we have 4 process histories documenting the creation of those digital files. Let's take this one. The event type, it's a preservation transfer. In this case, it could have been something else. Could have been creation of a derivative. And purpose of the event is a statement that we use to help describe the event. This date and time stamp shows up automatically when the processing history event is created, when the instance is created, as does this other information come up automatically as well. The input to this event was this our open real tape 6833. The output was this digital file with this file name. And the device chain was used, goes by this local name. It's a little more illustrative to actually look at the device chain. These are the devices that were in the chain. I had a Studer open reel tape machine, a Prism converter, a sound card, and a computer. And you'll notice here that the windows are starting to proliferate. This is a big problem with the application as it now stands that is being solved. So we will not have to drill down into so many windows to get at this metadata. But now we do. The playback machine was a Studer AA10 with a serial number. This is all created by default. You set this up once for your studio. You document all of your devices, combine them into chains, and then you just, for every time you do a processing history instance, you just pull the chain in. It doesn't take any time at all. And all you need to do then is change any settings that might have changed on your device. So it's a very efficient process with just a little bit of upfront labor. So settings on this tape machine, which playback head was used, the speed, EQ was set to NAB, the repro level, and azimuth, well, we just say that we adjusted it. And you would find similar settings for each of these devices here. So much of this metadata just copies over from your default chains and from device or from instance to instance and kind of goes along for the ride. You don't have to pay attention to all of this once you set it up the first time. You might then ask the question of how are these devices connected in your studio? And the AES standard will ask you to document that. And here is a virtual patch bay that allows you to patch your devices together. So here you can see this patch, the channel one out from the Studer going into analog input one from the Prism. The next patch is right here, AES out from the Prism into the Link sound card. And the next one, I have to do a little screen manipulation at this point to find it. It's right here, from the sound card into the computer. The software will spit out the appropriate XML to document this signal chain here. It's really impossible to show you this in any detail in a short session. I'm just showing you a couple more things. And I have this on my laptop. If anyone wants to play around with it during the rest of the conference, I'd be glad to show it to you. And I'm hoping to actually show this at an upcoming conference in the fall, in which case we'll be looking at a tool that will look very different and have some additional functionality. This graph, and this is also going to change as well, but you can see what it does. It graphically relates objects together. This is our open reel tape right here. And you can see that this open reel tape gave rise to four children. These are preservation master files. You can see that down here by the file, if you read the file name. These four preservation master files were combined into two production master files. These three were combined into one production master file for face one. That's where we had the three different regions because the tape changed speed, so we ended up with three digital files. And the second one into the second production file. Now, let's just look at one of these digital files and look at the ATMC metadata for it. So this is the ATMC record for this digital file with this file name here. This is a production master. Its use is production master. All of this format is collected when the file is parsed, so this all comes automatically. This is not something that we collect by hand. And here is the processing history instance for the creation of that derivative file. It was done by Catlin Hunter from the Library of Congress. How about that? And you can see it's the same kind of thing here. But it's documented. In this case, the audio object that we're documenting is a digital file. I'm going to stop there. I think that's probably enough of this. And again, if you have any questions, we'll take questions at the end of the session after Chris speaks. And I'll be happy to show you this in more detail if you're interested. So we're going to take just a moment's pause to do a laptop change, and then we'll have Chris Lesinek, who will continue on with embedded metadata, particularly the study that the ARCS Technical Committee, with significant help from ABPS, has done. I will say that really the most interesting part of this presentation is coming up, so don't go anywhere. I can't wait to hear what Chris has to say about this.
There you go. Thank you. Just the VGA was out here. All right, how's everybody doing? You awake? I think it should be an OSHA standard post-lunch metadata meetings must have extra oxygen pumped into the room. All right, well, thanks for coming. I appreciate it. Let me get this going. So I'm here in a few different capacities today. One is, of course, as part of the ARCS Technical Committee. The other is in my work is AES Standards Committees, where co-chair the Audio Metadata Committee, which oddly enough is not the one that's dealing with the standards Mike was referring to. That's a different one, which Mike and I are also heavily involved in. As Mike said, I'm going to be speaking about embedded metadata. And he did a good job of defining what embedded metadata is. It's essentially the metadata that lives with the file, which also contains the audio visual essence to which the metadata refers. So the question that emerges is, why embed metadata? And I'm pointing here, giving a shout out to the Federal Agencies Digitization Guidelines Initiative here, on some important and really great work that they've done, and we've been happy to be involved with. And I've highlighted two documents there that point to some good reading for anyone who's interested in looking into why they should embed in metadata. And it actually, Mike raised some good points about issues of synchronization and how to decide what to embed versus what to keep externally. And these documents actually speak to those and how this group at least has, you know, the decision points in navigating that conversation. This is specific to the federal agencies, but I think it's very worthwhile reading for everybody. This site in general, if you haven't seen it, digitizationguidelines.gov has a tremendous amount of great information on both still images and audiovisual. Why else? Because everybody else is doing it, right? We have embedded metadata popping up in everything from iPhones and flip cameras to P2 cameras and handheld audio devices. We have embedded metadata in this DV device here that's recording this. It's going to give us the date and time stamp. It's going to give us let us know every time he hits stop and start on the camera and all those good things. Software applications, WaveLab, Final Cut Pro, iMovie, anything these days is dealing with embedded metadata, all the way up to asset management systems and workflow systems. It's essential. And distribution platforms and access, so things like iTunes or YouTube or Lala or any number of Hulu and all these things that use embedded metadata. But, you know, the question is not necessarily should we embed metadata anymore. As I just pointed out, it exists, and to do our job as archivists, we need to be aware of it. So on one side of the equation, we have the conversation of whether we should embed metadata, and that's relative to the reformatting of analog assets. On the other side of the equation is we really don't have a choice. It's an integral part of the of the objects will be accessioning into archives. And to not be aware of it, as I say here, to ignore it is to effectively decatalog, right? I mean, one of our biggest challenges is the attainment of intellectual control, identification, inspection. We face it on a daily basis in physical archives. We get a lot of great information in this embedded metadata that we can use now to deal with the tremendous growth we've seen in the creation of audiovisual content. So we have some tools, some capabilities available to us with Born Digital. So my take is if we're going to be dealing with this anyway, we should be thinking about it for all types of digital objects that we're managing, and be aware of that. Why is it important to archives? In large part, it speaks to, particularly with Born Digital content, authenticity and integrity. So it tells us things about provenance. We can identify primary sources. It can give us some really essential information with regard to the nature of the asset that we're dealing with. We use it in management, things like Mike was talking about, you know, rights things or rights issues, things, access master versus preservation master, all sorts of management activities, identification and description I talked about, and to some extent, redundancy and backup. So if a file becomes disassociated from its database, we have some means of identifying the source from which it came, the copyright information and things along those lines. But it's not just important to archives. As I said, it's important to end users, production and post-production facilities. Like I said, editing systems are using this. Cameras are creating it. Creators of content, rights holders. And we've seen this a lot with photographers and emerge as a rights holders issue, where we've seen much more sophisticated embedded metadata management within photo applications. And that's because photographers have been great advocates for this, primarily because they generally hold rights to the content that they're creating. We also see it in forensics and legal systems coming up, and I'll give you an example of that. First, though, just on the end user, can you imagine if your iTunes looked like this, right? This would be iTunes without embedded metadata. Users would not go for this. If you are a band and you want to be heard and you put your stuff up online and you have no embedded metadata, users are likely not going to, one, find you, and two, like putting their content into your iTunes system. So another place where we see it in the end users is, so on my iPhone, right, I tell the iPhone to go ahead and document where I am. When it takes a picture and it embeds a GPS, longitude and latitude coordinates, and I can now go into iPhoto and hit a map and I can select pictures based on geographic location, right? We also have GPS data being embedded in cameras and audio recorders and all kinds of things these days. So this is really valuable and creates a much more rich experience, and that's all from embedded metadata. Metadata is embedded in case law. As I say here, this is a case in the Supreme Court in Arizona where an opinion was made that, and I've highlighted the pertinent point in the bottom, that embedded metadata is subject to disclosure under public record laws. This had to do with someone, this was a Word document or something along those lines, where a document was backdated in the document itself, but the embedded metadata showed when the document was actually created. So this was a labor law issue where embedded metadata became part of the forensics, if you will. So and along the lines of Mike's example, can anybody tell me what this is? Air Force One, yeah. See the shutters in the background. Well, inside this photo, and I actually have to give credit to Dave Rice, my colleague. This is his example. I'm stealing it. But embedded in this file, and this is just a snapshot of it, there's much more than this, is all of this information. So we have information about, you know, this is stuff we're familiar with. I think people who've worked in Photoshop and stuff, we see that it was taken with a Canon. We see whether the flash was used or not. We have all kinds of information, stuff that, as Mike said, was machine created, and then we also have some information in there that was put in under, you know, they put a standard copyright statement, and then they have an image description. So this, they want to be sure that I'm not saying that the that I'm not sending you this message here when I use this this image. So I'm not saying that. Obama does not endorse. All right. So also within this, it's a high resolution enough image. We can zoom in and we see this is the Watchgate scandal, I'm calling it. So we've got the creation date and time of in that file I just showed you says that this is 7:55 p.m., not 7:59 p.m., like Obama's watch says. So we can somebody call Fox News and tell them that. So anyway, it brings home an interesting point, though, right? We have 2 points of metadata we can corroborate and look at. So let's look at, in particular, embedded metadata in WAV files, and I'll first talk about kind of how metadata is organized, and that is in chunks. A WAV file is made up of something called chunks, as in data. I think of it as a chunk of data. There's nothing more complex than that. This is an example of a way to look at the chunks. So each row that we see there is a chunk, and the first column there tells us the location of that chunk in the file. The second, I'm sorry, did I say row? I meant column. The first column says location. The second column gives us the size of that chunk. So we can look at this is a WAV file, and we can see the full structure of it. The two that I'm pointing out here are not necessarily embedded metadata standards, although the format chunk does give us technical metadata. Mike showed us a screenshot of inside ATMC that he said all this data is parsed, it's not entered in, and that actually is parsed from the format chunk. So ATMC goes into the format chunk and pulls that metadata out. And this is another example. This is the format chunk manifest in iTunes. So iTunes aware of the format chunk. When you hit Apple I or get information on a file and you go to that tab, you see that it tells us it's a WAV file. It tells us what the sample rate and bit rate are and all those good things. The format chunk information is essential for any player to know what the specifications of the file are so that they can play it back correctly. So it's an essential part of any WAV file. And then the data chunk looks like this.
I am the Edison photograph created right.
It is the audio itself. So the format chunk and the data chunk are the two essential parts of a WAV file. And then we can add in all these great things as well. These are other chunks. And I've identified, we've got list info, XMP, AXML, IXML, and BEX, and I'm going to tell you about each of those now. But we're looking at a WAV file that's populated with lots of metadata here, as well as we still see the format and the data chunk. So list info goes back to the creation of RIF and WAV file. It comes out of Microsoft and IBM. It goes back to the early Windows development for audio, how audio works on the Windows system. It's been implemented, list info now, not WAV files. List info has been implemented fairly widely, not necessarily adopted that much, but we see it represented in lots of applications, and I'll tell you more about that in a bit. It was intended, if you go back and look at the early developer documentation, there's these things that they say in the developer handbook that says there's this whole registration process, what you're supposed to do when you want to create a chunk, and you register it with Microsoft, and then it goes into a registry. Well, that never happened. It's easy enough just to create your own, and people did that, and they didn't register, and then other people adopted it. So you end up with something that's supposed to be registered, but it's effectively extensible, and it's been done in an unmanaged way. So we have applications that look at list info chunks selectively, and I'll give some examples of that. And there's effectively no authoritative list of what are all the list info chunks because of this, but here's a list of some. And you'll see that it's largely descriptive. We see copyright information in there, engineer, what the source format was, what software was used, technician. So we have technical, some administrative, some descriptive, all sorts of things in there. BEXT is the chunk that defines the difference between a WAV file and a broadcast WAV format. It's this small set of fields. BEXT chunk comes out of the European Broadcasting Union. It is a standard, a published standard. It's 3285. It is broadcast oriented. It was developed specifically for broadcasters. And it's this small set of prescribed fields. So we have description, originator, originator reference. So this is the Beck chunk. These are, it's a prescribed set of fields. It's also, as opposed to list info, you can type in lots and lots of data and list info. There's not much controls. It's kind of free text. There's a few fields that have some controls, like date fields. But Bext is very controlled. It's limited number of characters for the most part. And it's very prescribed. It's fairly difficult to work on. It's not that flexible. However, it's existed. It added more data, metadata than was in a WAV file, is widely adopted and used. So it's become the standard that people have in the archives community have attached onto, because it gives us more metadata, which we like, and it's had a wide adoption and it's a standard. So those are three things that we like a lot. But it leaves us wanting more. And in thinking of that, we kind of, in wanting more than Bext, this is exactly where IXML came out of. This is a consortium of manufacturers that looked at Bext and said, this really is not going to suit our needs. We need to come up with something that's more extensive. IXML is production-centric as opposed to broadcast-centric. It was created explicitly, it's explicitly stated to supersede the Bext chunk. It's had fairly strong adoption. You see it in lots of applications, again, production applications. It's not a standard. It's managed by this consortium of manufacturers. And interestingly enough, I went to go grab the schema off their website, and it says, we are not distributing the schema. And I can't remember what the wording is. It's funny, but it's interesting that they're not publishing the schema. However, they have sample instances of IXML documents that you can look at. So IXML is attractive in that it gives us more fields, but it's prescribed. So it's not extensible outside of some kind of informal process of going back to this consortium and saying, hey, I think we should do this, and there being an agreement and it being incorporated into the schema, which you can't access. So that's IXML. We have AXML, which is a standard that comes out of EBU. It's actually an extension of the broadcast wave format. Again, this kind of, it took kind of parallel tracks. It's not such a linear path as I might paint it out to be here, but basically the metadata standard called the EBU core, a Dublin core based metadata standard. That's kind of what is the essential information that we'd like to have about an object. The EBU came up with what's called the EBU core. AXML became a place where they started thinking about, boy, it'd be nice to embed the EBU core inside of the AXML chunk. It's all XML based. So we have AXML as an option. It supports any valid XML. So you run into the wonders and the horrors of endless extensibility and flexibility. But it will accept any valid XML, which is interesting. So you could theoretically validate against using your own systems if you had your own schema. But it gives us a lot of flexibility. It's a standard. We like that. However, we have not seen any adoption outside of use in customized systems within generally larger organizations. XMP comes from Adobe. It's created and it's actively managed by Adobe. It's all open. It's openly documented. They have free open source. I don't know if open source is correct or not, but a free developer toolkit that you can download and work with this and extend it however you like. They have sample schemas that you can use if you like. That some Dublin core based, some rights based. They have all sorts of schemas that they've developed which you can use. There is no registration process, however. So and maybe they took a cue off of what happened with Microsoft and IBM and ListInfo. But there is no registry to which you create, say, for instance, the federal agency's XMP standard, and you register it with Adobe, and then it becomes part of the registry. But again, XML-based, very flexible. And on the other hand, as opposed to AXML, we've seen... Well, I say highly adopted, but now I'm not talking about it. In audio, you'll see that there's very low adoption. However, XMP is a standard that's used a lot. We see it in PDF and in images, and there's documentation and plans for it, navigating basically to all document types. So that's interesting. So basically, you know, between these standards, you can pretty much do anything you want to do these days. I mean, we were for a long time restricted to ListInfo and Bext, and it was limiting. You know, now we almost have the opposite problem. We have lots of options. Now we really have to get our act together and figure out, you know, what type of standards and schemas we want to develop for embedding. So that's the challenge at this point. We now have the capability. It exists. And so the ARSTC metadata study is a study that was performed by myself, led, under the auspices of the ARS Technical Committee, which gave lots of invaluable feedback and guidance. It's taken on by myself and Walter Forsberg, who's a student at Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Program at NYU, as an independent study. And we had major contributions from Tom Endres, Tommy Soyberg, Bruce Gordon, and Preston Cabe at those organizations. So we wanted to look at a few things. We wanted to look at interoperability related to embedded metadata between applications. And as I say there, we're primarily focused on end-user audio applications, and I'll tell you which ones we looked at, but used for recording, editing, and playback. So the types of applications that we're all typically working with in a lab environment and being used for preservation purposes. And we wanted to look at the persistence and integrity of embedded metadata as it travels within one application, but across applications as well. So as we move from, you know, WaveLab to SoundForge to whatever, what happens to that embedded metadata? Does it persist and does it maintain its integrity? So this is important. You know, we've established, we see federal agencies group taking a lead in saying, yes, embedded metadata is important. Here's why we feel it's significant. So now that we've decided that, you know, that yes, it is important, what happens when we actually act on that? We wanted to see. So the results of this will be, it's not done yet, it's still in draft form, but a report. We generated test methods and reference files, which we think will be valuable, we will make available. All of this will be available from the ARSC website. So we now have a test method that's been vetted by the technical committee and these reference files that people can use. You know, aside from the information that we're publishing, we can use it for further testing, but people can also use these to do their own testing and make selection around applications or as periodic tests, because as you'll see later, even within one application, as different builds or versions come out, metadata can change. And then we're also going to make available all of the raw data. So we'll have the reference files, but we'll also have the resulting files. So we're trying to be as open as possible and give as much information as possible for people to do their own analysis, to repeat the test themselves. The general process was this, that we drafted the test method. It was vetted by the ARSTC, as I said. We generated reference files, and primarily what we did was using an application, which I'll show you next, we put lots of metadata in a systematic way into these files and then used them in applications and saw what happened to that embedded metadata. We performed the tests, we analyzed the results, draft the report, publishing it. And the primary thing here is it's not a surprise to anybody. This is not a spoiler to say that the results were not great. It's something that we've all been aware of for a long time. But this is the first time we're quantifying it. And I think the most important takeaway from this is the advocacy that needs to come out of this in order to raise awareness about, yes, we think this is important, and we would like to see manufacturers take action in developing their systems under a recommended set of guidelines on behaviors and to be aware of the metadata that we feel is important. And you might ask, well, archives has never had much of a voice with manufacturers, but as I pointed out, this is significant. Embedded metadata relates to not only archives, but to every point in the life cycle for audiovisual assets. So the applications we tested were WaveLab, Adobe Audition, Audacity, Bias Peak, two versions, Avid Pro Tools LE version 8.01, Apple iTunes, and Steinberg Nuendo, and actually, we have a couple of others that we haven't looked at yet that we just got results from. and they'll be added to this list. So this was not based on anything other than what applications do we have in the our technical committee available to us. So we had a handful available to us between AVPS and NYU, and then there, the people who I said contributed in, earlier in their document, they had applications we didn't have access to. We supplied them with the test methods and the files, and they performed the tests as well. So this is what we came up with. It was as simple as that. So the test one looked at interoperability. We wanted to generate reference files. We generated reference files. We opened them in applications, and we tried to figure out where the embedded metadata that we systematically entered, if it showed up, and if so, where did it end up? And we also looked at, we wanted to see if there was any semantic shifts. So a semantic shift could be something where either the label assigned to a field in an application's interface is labeled differently than the intention of that, if that makes sense. So for instance, if the field in the Beck standard is called description, but the application calls it artist, that would be a semantic shift in the label, right? Also, we wanted to see if there was any things that happened at the field level, whether it mapped data in any interesting way that changed the semantic meaning. So to be clear, this test is specifically an interface test. We just opened it up and we wanted to see where it displayed it. And these are the results. You see lots of red. That's bad. but you know, we see. And I should say, I want to be clear, this test is not, I will be used this way no matter what I say, but this test is not to recommend a specific application. I want to be clear about that. This test is to approach this at a more fundamental level and to have all of these applications be aware of the needs and to step up and support embedded metadata. But so these were our results, and you see on the left column that I tried to color just for different chunks. At the top is Bex, in the middle is list info, and then XMP, AXML, and IXML at the bottom. So you see no support for AXML or IXML in the display that these applications offered to the user. We see XMP only supported by Adobe, which is no surprise. And then we kind of have these gray areas, these yellow ones that stuff's a little funky, and you can read the report on the details of those. But generally speaking, not a whole lot of support for embedded metadata, right? The other tests we wanted to look at were persistence and integrity. So basically, test two had four subtests. It was basically open up a file with tons of embedded metadata, go to a chunk, edit a field in that chunk, save it, close it. What happens? The other one was go into a file that, for instance, had all of the chunks except for Bex, let's say, add the Bex chunk, see what happens. So that first one looks at kind of what happens on a field level within that chunk. The other one is what happens on a chunk level. The other one was to edit audio, open the file, edit audio of an application to see what happens. And then the other one was just simply open the file, save as, and see what happens. And then open those files and analyze what did happen. This was the gist of it. Basically, if it was something that didn't display, for the most part, it deleted it. So that chart that I showed with a lot of red, you know, the ones that were red would get deleted. For the most part, there were exceptions to this. There were less exceptions to that happening within chunks. Meaning if we change the description field in Bex, that it erases the coding history in the other Bex fields. And there were more exceptions to deleting entire chunks, so just altogether deleting the AXML or IXML chunk if we don't support it. A couple of apps just automatically appended fields with information that we didn't want to put in there. So things that, you know, are useful, I'm sure, have a purpose. It wasn't, there's an intention behind that, but in thinking about the impact of that to the integrity of that data, it was potentially troubling. That happened primarily in the Bex and the IXML chunks, which makes sense because those are, like we said, those are kind of the production-centric and broadcast-centric standards. So So they have, you know, earlier when I was saying that embedded metadata is useful for workflows, well, and in some sense they're exploiting that and they're using that. That's why they appended this data. And we saw differing behaviors between audio edits versus metadata edits. So those four tests, we didn't know if we'd see the same thing, same behavior across the board or differing behaviors, and it was differing actually. The test three was just to create derivatives, a lower res WAV file, an MP3 and FLAC. And see what happened. How did the application map that data to ID3 tags in MP3 or to FLAC tags in FLAC, or in a WAV file? Did they carry over into the derivative? The results were that almost no applications supported FLAC as a default, and we didn't get very good results on that. The WAV derivatives. It really ranged dramatically from everything persisted, all of the chunks persisted when you created a lower res wave, to full deletion of everything, to just the BEX persisting. So we saw everything in between, no erasing everything, or just erasing some things. We did see the most support in derivative creation for MP3s. We did see the most support for mapping to ID3 within most from list info to ID3 within MP3, but it was variable. It was selected. You know, one application would map four fields, another one would map six. They were different fields, so there was no consistent behavior. So further testing we'd like to do is to develop. We'd like to do further testing, more applications and different types of applications. This test was originally better designed for non-multi-track applications, though we tested Pro Tools and Nuendo, and we actually had some very interesting results when we tested those. But we'd like to develop some more multi-track oriented tests, part of which is adding mono reference files. We created stereo reference files, which didn't work for certain applications. One thing that we know exists is that a lot of applications don't enforce the standard. So, for instance, an application may use the BEX chunk, but it doesn't actually enforce the rules. So it doesn't actually validate the data that you're putting in against it. So we'd like to look at which applications actually enforce the standards and which ones just let you do whatever you want. Overarching results, we saw the most support for BEXT. We saw the most followed by the selected fields of list info, IXML, and then XMP, and then absolutely none for AXML. And again, what I termed display to play here was kind of the modus operandi that happened, meaning that if it didn't display it, it deleted it in large part. There was no consistent display or management across applications or within applications, like I said earlier. Metadata management within an application will change from build to build, from version to version. So we tested, one version of Peak and another version of Peak, and they acted very differently. This makes me think that having those reference files and test methods out there is a good thing. This may be routine tests that people should do in their systems, just like we do signal path tests and things like that. We need some changes to take place. Which has to do with our next steps. So as a result of part of the report, we'd like to have conclusions that look at recommendations on metadata support within applications and guidelines for metadata management and handling within applications. Primarily, we want to say don't delete stuff that you don't know what it is, which is a premise of WAV files in general. I mean, part of the original WAV... It's actually written. I mean, applications are supposed to behave that way anyway. It's written into the original WAV specifications. If you don't know what a chunk is, leave it alone. Which is one reason why WAV files are attractive, because applications tend to not break when you have odd things in them that are specific to a certain application. But we don't want those things deleted. So we want to publish the report with these recommendations. Like I said, we have the test methods and reference files available. And we need to do some advocacy here on getting this to happen. You know, I'd like to see, for those of us in the room that are involved in AES, I'd like to see some work, some advocacy within the technical committees, the standards committees, and the publications, the journal, and things like that that take place. I think, you know, just publishing this, I'd like, on the ARSC website, will do a lot of good. And within other organizations that have a common interest in this. So, you know, and obviously we're open to other ideas about that. It's the last bullet point there. But it's clear that we need to do some advocacy on this because it's an important issue. How much time do I have left, you know?
15.
All right, okay, so I'll go through this fast. So I'm going to switch over to talking about BWF MetaEdit, which is an application, an open source and freely available application that comes out of the federal agency's digitizations guidelines initiative, specifically the audiovisual working group, led by Carl Fleischauer, and Kate Murray's also a big actor in there, and a lot of great people in these committees. So they hired Audiovisual Preservation Solutions to look into this embedded metadata and development of an application for primarily the initial thing was we'd like to have a tool that can do batch embedding of metadata. So we have lots of data sources, everything from spreadsheets to three different legacy databases to Word documents that have legacy data, and we've got all these WAV files that we'd like to embed in. How can we make that happen so that we can map that data into those files and do some metadata embedding now that we've decided it's something that we want to do? Also, to have something that we could do that on the individual level, so you know, as you're doing, as an engineer could use as they're creating files. Ultimately, BWF MetaEdit is what we came up with, and I'm not being too modest here by saying that it changes the landscape for how people work with embedded metadata and WAV files, but I really feel that it's true. We've effectively created a really lightweight application, multi-platform. It's open source. It's freely available. This is an application that can be installed on, should be installed on, the vision is that it's installed on anybody's computer that is taking active part in the object's life cycle. So far, embedded metadata has been stored away inside of specialized audio applications that live in the studio, and we wanted to free embedded metadata from that environment. We felt that would make workflows more efficient, higher integrity, better controls, and kind of take the burden off of that one point in the workflow. So you know, we have everything from graphical user interface, which is what I'm going to show you, to command line interfaces that can be used behind the scenes in systems to do batch embedding and editing and all these types of things. And there's lots of really great features. It was decided early on that it was important that we not only support XML for importing and exporting, but CSV that can be opened up in any spreadsheet application and edited, because lots of people work that way. It's something that people are used to doing. People like to work in that environment and are familiar with it. It also provides some really nice ability to do filtering and data sorting and you know, some more systematic editing and monitoring. We have you know, global and field specific writing of data, so we give access to all of those chunks that I just mentioned earlier, and you can write data into them either, you know, very field specific or in very comprehensive amounts. There's an undo command, very important for a batch metadata editor, right? And audio-only MD5 checksum creation and RF64 support. So one key thing about this, the problem that we had to solve was, okay, I talked about all these various data sources that we're working with, is how do we, you know, and we have on the flip side of that embedded metadata, a lot of standards that have certain, you know, rules, as I was talking about, that certain applications do and don't enforce. So how do we have to get from point A to point B? And the solution that we came up with is called a conformance, what we labeled the conformance point document. So this is one common structure that we say, all right, you have to get your various data sources from this variety of sources into one common structure, and then we can do batch embedding and editing and things like that. It also allowed us, it gives us a way to validate against those standards in a more controlled manner. And this conformance point document is what I was talking about. It's either CSV or XML-based, and I'll show you that in a minute. So this is the conformance point, document situation I just described with multiple data sets being mapped to the CPD, stands for conformance point document, and then embedded into, used by BWF MetaEdit to embed. So I'm going to show you a couple of things here. So this is BWF MetaEdit. It's not a great interface, I'll admit, but it's effective in what we need it to do. So let me open up a file here. So one thing is that, so this is a, for instance, a number of directories, right? And I can, these have not only WAV files, but other types of data. So I can just drag and drop those in. It'll ignore everything that's not a WAV file. So it's going to open these WAV files up. Maybe I shouldn't have dragged so much. I've got lots of stuff. I'm going to let it go. So we've got, while this is going, we've got a couple of things here. We've got tech and core. These are two different tabs. I can't. All right. Oh, Bort. You won. All right. Of course. What's this going on? Oh, man. Let me force quit. It's a rite of passage. All right. So we've got the core set here. So this tells us the file name here, and if this is actually the full file path, if you have, you guys get cut off there, or can you see the full screen? Can't see from here. So that'll show you the full file path if it differs across directories. And then these are, so this is populated with this. We typed in Bex description, Bex originator. This is one of our reference files, actually. So we entered this data in. So these are the Bex fields, right, up through coding history. And then we start to see the list info fields, all of which we entered data into here. Editing is as simple as double-clicking and editing. We can type anything in that we want there. And when we do, we get, it tells us that it's changed. We have a field level undo, so I can go back and see what values existed before I changed it, and I can change it again. So this is great if you have lots of files open, you're doing lots of editing, and then you make a mistake, you don't have to close everything. So I have all previous, my whole history of stuff there that I can go back to and select. So it's got the full list info list that I showed you. There's also that technical metadata. So the metadata here, we see this comes out of the format chunk. We have a list of here of showing unsupported chunks, so chunks that are in the WAV file that BWF MetaEdit doesn't support, which is interesting because you can see what types of information applications are embedding in that's proprietary to them. They do that all the time, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but good to know about. It tells us whether we have a BEX chunk, our info chunk, and then we have XMP, AXML, and IXML data here that we can support. So this is XML data, albeit with some spaces in between. But we see this is an IXML chunk that we can edit there. And so we can open up and edit any of the XML chunks. The audio-only checksum here, this tells us it's a red, bad, right? Universal. So it had an MD5 value stored in it for the audio only. So that data chunk where then I said I played the file, audio file, I said this is the data chunk. So it performs an MD5 checksum only on the audio. And you can, if you like, embed that in the file itself. And if you select the preference here to evaluate, you can, all your preference settings are here, evaluate MD5, verify MD5, embed, and embed and allow overwriting. So if you say evaluate, it will check the MD5 when you open and verify it against the MD5 stored. If it doesn't match, it turns red. So we would know in this case that our audio has been altered. And it gives us an error message here that it did not, the MD5 didn't validate. So just to look at the preference settings here, which I just minimized. What do with that? Sorry, now I'm in a different world here. Actually, I'll show you the help menu, which is got a lot of information. So it goes through all of the tech fields and descriptions, describes everything. It describes all the chunks that exist, BEX, list info, XML-based chunks. And then actually it has a couple of sample workflows that you can follow through to use as a little tutorial to get used to the tool and how it works. So let me run through, what do I have, like 5 minutes or something? All right, I'll just run through one activity. And that is, why don't I open up, so I'll open up files with no metadata in them and embed them. So you guys can see that. So here I dropped it in. We're looking at the tech window now. So if I go to core, we see that there's no metadata here. Now, creating the conformance point document, I mentioned that it's a certain structure, and Mike mentioned earlier that it's important to have tools that allow you to do that. So you can actually, when you bring your, you can create your conformance point document from this tool. So I can come in, I can say export the core document would be it in CSV format. I'll call this activity 2. I'll store that there. So I just created my conformance point document, and the important thing about doing that is when I dump those files in, it maintains all of the directory paths. That's the most important challenge. So if I have lots of directories with lots of files, right, 10 different folders, I can drop and drag them into BWF MetaEdit and create this document just by exporting the CSV, and it has my full file path here. So as I add information, which I could just do as easily as this, right, which I won't fill all those out and make you guys watch me do that. I'll use one that we've got. Stop it. All right. So this is our populated CSV. Okay, so that's after I've populated. I just go to import core document, activity 2, populated CSV, and open it. So this now brings in all the metadata that would be in those fields that you saw. It tells me that they've changed and that they're green. And you can do something important here because a lot of people may have embedded metadata existing in files. So we can say there's an option, don't overwrite any existing embedded metadata. Or you can, if you know that you have three fields that you don't want to overwrite, but one that you do, you can do field-specific overwriting. So if there's only one you want to change where you know there's information. So then embedding this is as simple as save all modified files, and it's done. So we just embedded, you know, all this metadata inside of these file, all 7 or 8 of these files here. Embedding, there is a batch embedding via the command line. Right now we don't have it via the graphical user interface. And there's the caveat that this tells you, which is that this tool does not validate against schemas at this point. So this is kind of use at your own risk type thing, or you need to do validation somewhere else. But entering into that field is as simple as, let's see, do I have, well, that's a conformance point document. I think I've got a XML. Well, I can copy and paste. I don't have much there to look at. But anyway, I can open up an XML document, select all, copy, and paste into this, say OK, and it's done. I'll just point out, too, that for quality control, this application has been, in some ways, surprisingly useful. And that's because we incorporated a file validation rule. So it checks the structure of the file, and in ways that tools like the original Jove tool did not. So Jove would tell you that a file was fine when in actuality there were some issues with it, is what we discovered. And we've been talking with the people behind Jove, Steve Abrams and Hannah Frost, we've worked with, we've shared files, we're sharing information. So Jove 2.0 is going to look to correct those. But here I just put in two invalid files. One tells me that this file has two IXML chunks, which makes it invalid. The other one says that this file here was truncated. And if we open that file up in iTunes, we'd find that everything about that file looks fine. It will play back in iTunes, for instance. It says it's 40 minutes long, but the actual audio content is 9 minutes long. So this might happen if you download something from FTP and the FTP gets interrupted. All the header information comes and only some of the audio, but not everything. So it looks like everything's there. In many ways, this could easily be passed on and missed. But this validates and says that it's not a valid document. So we have an errors log. And besides that, besides those field level undos, you see this undo last save operation. So if I did commit to all those saves and I wanted to undo that, I could do that. And QC, this will be my last point, but the QC has also been, I think has some great potential. This is just a document that I exported where I think, you know, you have all this data in Excel, and you have some interesting opportunities such as using, for instance, filtering, right? So we can go to the originator, for instance, and I can see all of a sudden that, I know that I'm supposed to have Museum of Modern Art for all of my values, but I see that I have one Museum of Art instead, so I can select that and go to that. You can sort data according to, you know, originator or originator reference. We can filter again, and I know I want to check, you know, these files, and that I know that these are supposed, the descriptions of those are supposed to match. And of course, there's equations you can do in here that say, you know, if this equals this, then good, if not, bad. All right. And it tells us good. So we could set up some spreadsheets if we have structured enough information to pipe those in, not have to hand type those in every time. But you can all of a sudden start to qualify files if we know that all we could filter by only show me files that contain AM in them for Access Master, for instance. And all we know, all of our Access Masters are supposed to be, you know, 44.1, 16-bit. We could do these automatic quality control checks. Of course, there's other ways to do that too, but I think this gives a lot of capability to people who don't have necessarily extensive IT support and systems in place. Just the ease to work within Excel or other spreadsheet applications is great. Now, there are some caveats. Excel will do some nasty things if you don't bring in the document right. For instance, time and data information, it wants to help you out and automatically correct it, right? So you can, if you import it instead of just simply opening it, you can get around that. You just have to tell it how to act. When you import, you can say what the tab delimiters are, your comma-separated values, and how to treat the information, which that's in the documentation as well. So anyway, there's Mike said, there's a lot, you know, that I could show you, but that's all the time we have. The tool is not available now. It's currently, the Library of Congress is, actually, this is a very interesting point. So the Library of Congress wants to, or I shouldn't say just the Library of Congress, I think federal agencies, but the Library of Congress is leading it with Carl Fleischauer, wants to put this on SourceForge, but there was actually no capability within SourceForge to put something on as public domain. So they actually worked with the SourceForge people to create that capability within SourceForge, and this will be one of the first projects that goes on to SourceForge as a public domain project, which is really interesting. So it's literally, you know, any day now, right? But it really is moving along, and should be very soon that it's available. And we're continuing to make updates too. So we're on version 1.2 now, and continuing to work on it. So thank you very much.
we're over time, so why don't I propose that we continue the discussion up there if anybody has questions.
Okay, great. Thanks, everybody.